If your morning starts with snap, crackle, pop, and it's not your cereal, call Joint Relief Institute for fast-lasting joint pain relief. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. 708-888-0000.
Emily Brewster is a senior editor for Merriam-Webster. I saw recently a story about, or by her, about the new words that are in the Webster Dictionary, the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. There's 538 or so either new definitions for words or brand new outright words. For instance, let's just see how well you guys are at this. Lapka, she's out. Bertrand, you're in. Producer Elif, you're in. Cross-sell. What does cross-sell mean?
Cross-sell is when you, that's like, it's good if you go kitty corner in your prison cell and you see your roommate.
I was going to say it's when two brands help each other.
Thank you, Elif.
With marketing.
It's a possibility.
Cynophobia, C-Y-N-O-P-H-O-B-I-A, cynophobia, cynophobia. It's a noun. It's the pathological fear or loathing of dogs.
Why is it S or C-Y-N-O?
C-Y-N-O. I don't know. You would think it would be something like canine or something like that. You know what's in here? And I can't believe that it's only now in here. There's a lot of words like this. Dad joke. I think we all know what a dad joke is.
It's funny.
It's something that's really funny.
I'd laugh and laugh and laugh.
I should be paid for those. A wholesome joke of the type said to be told by fathers with a punchline that is often an obvious or predictable pun or play on words and usually judged to be endearingly corny or unfunny, Steve Bertrand.
Not possible.
It says unfunny in the definition.
It literally says that.
All right.
That's kind of mean. It's mean, you know?
Careful, she's on the phone line right now.
But, when, you know, people accuse you of a dad joke. That's a mean thing to say about someone.
Oh, well, I don't think that that doesn't mean that it doesn't have
some truth.
There's applications for
sure,
it.
Right.
There is such a thing as a dad joke.
Yeah, but you wouldn't go up and call someone ugly.
Emily, explain yourself.
I'm happy to try. The definition of dad joke reflects the ways that the word is used in the language, so it is certainly not a judgment by Merriam-Webster about the funniness of dad jokes generally.
I don't know what she just said, but it sounded good to me.
Reminds me of a story, I can tell you.
Yeah, funny thing you should say that. So a duck walks into a bar. Emily Brewster is a senior editor for Merriam-Webster. How many new words or definitions of words did you put out? 530-something?
More than 530. I don't actually remember the exact count. Might have been 536, 8, something like that.
I think. So I have a list of some of the words. Will you walk through them with me?
Sure.
And before we maybe get to some specific ones, how is it that a word or a new definition makes it into the list? How do you sort of curate the language that way?
Well, we are constantly, we have a staff of lexicographers at Merriam-Webster, and we are constantly working on adding terms to the dictionary. So we are looking for new words and new meanings of existing words. And we do this all the time. The work on it never actually stops. But because the dictionary is kind of by its nature a circular work, any change that you make to one entry might affect a different entry. And so we always make the actual change to the website for a whole batch of words at one time, because we wouldn't want to have implications that aren't addressed. So we make these announcements usually two times a year, but sometimes three times a year when we've just gotten to the deadline that we set for ourselves, and this is what we were able to do, and
here's
so here are the words.
But it would
that's right.
So do y'all kind of walk around with notepads or mental notepads, and when you hear a word or phrase pop up now and again, you go, "Wow, do we have that in our dictionary? And is it being used often enough that it merits inclusion in the dictionary?" Is that kind of what you do?
Absolutely. That's exactly it. I'm constantly writing myself notes about terms that I need to check into. And certainly, we are always looking to see a term that is new to us. As editors, we then will go and research it and determine, okay, how old is this? And what sort of evidence do we have of it in use? Is it being just used in really informal sources, or is it appearing in academic journals? Is it being used in the kinds of reading materials that a lot of people are going to be coming in contact with? Because when it is, then we know that it's an established member of the language, and then it's eligible for entry.
And you don't pass judgment, huh? Because I'm one of these stuffy people. For instance, when I text, I write in full sentences. I've never used an emoji or even an emoticon in my life, and I won't. I learned language as an eighth grader, and I was told there are certain rules, and I kind of respect them. So I'm not very flexible at all. It looks like you guys are more flexible than me.
Yes, I would say that that's true. We really welcome change in the language. And in this business, you really have to, because it's inevitable. The language is constantly being pushed and stretched by its speakers, and it has been for 1,000 years.
I guess I want to amend what I just said. I'll own my rigidity about this. I appreciate the language changes. But what bothers me is that people don't take the time or the care to express themselves as well as the language allows. We're abbreviating things. We're putting symbols in for thoughts. And I think, you know, the language is such a beautiful and important and developed thing that to just ignore it or sometimes trash it is a shame. And I think it reflects a sort of coarsening of our culture. I mean all of these things I'm saying, or even lack of education or lack of curiosity about our language. I hate to see everything just reduced to symbols and acronyms. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I see a lot of these kind of clipped forms, like we just entered INSPO, short for inspiration. I see these as being all about mostly a playfulness with the language. And playfulness in the English language is very well established as an impulse, and I think it's one that can be applauded without degrading the language. And I think about the origin of the word okay, which is undoubtedly the English language's best export. Of all the people around the world who know only a handful of English words, okay is likely to be one of them. And this word was a playful coinage by a journalist. It was a deliberate misspelling of the phrase all correct, O-L-L, K-O-R-R-E-C-T. This is in, I don't know, the 1830s, somewhere around there. And it then got shortened to OK, and then it got lengthened, of course, to O-K-A-Y. But it was originally this very playful, very playful representation of a deliberate misspelling. And I think that it's maybe helpful to think about that kind of history in the language. The person who made that up was, in theory, a highly skilled user of the language. This was a person whose job it was to write. And often these other shortened terms that we're encountering now are similarly coined by people who are good, solid users of English and are being playful with it.
Glad you said all of that. So then let's look at some of these words and phrases. Some of them, it's surprising to me, aren't there. Deep state. That's new enough that it now gets inclusion. I guess it just shows how focused we are on some topics these days, because I thought deep state would have been in there by now.
Deep state is a term that we are watching for quite a while, and it can be surprising to note just how suddenly a word becomes kind of ubiquitous in a way that it seems like it's been around for forever. It only dates to the year 2000, and initially it was used in reference to conversations about Turkey and then about Egypt. It's really only been in the past 4 or 5 years that it has been a term that is being used about American politics.
Oh, yeah, that's where I know it. An alleged secret network of especially non-elected government officials. Escape room, a game in which participants confined to a room or other enclosed setting, such as a prison cell, are given a set amount of time to find a way to escape. Escape room. Fatberg is in here. What's a fatberg?
Oh, a fatberg. I wish it were as fun as it sounds. It's a large mass of fat and solid waste that collects in a sewer system. Ugh.
I guess that does not get kicked around in Chicago. I have not heard us in our city describe the problems with fatbergs. Maybe New York or Philadelphia have those things. I don't know. Free solo. I'm just working alphabetically here. Made famous for some of us by a documentary film about a famous free solo climber. That probably helped propel the word, huh?
Yes, it did, indeed. That word, again, it's been kind of percolating in the language since the early 1980s, but that documentary brought the word into far broader use than it had been.
Molly is in there, and I know that's you know, street for ecstasy. You guys have formalized that now. Molly is a noun. And
that's right.
Prior to now, I would not have found ecstasy as a definition for Molly in your dictionary, huh?
That's true.
Inspo, you mentioned inking. We all know what inking is. That's tattooing or a tattoo, right?
Mm-hmm.
Pickleball, yeah, indoor-outdoor game that is played on a level court with shorthanded paddles. A buddy of mine plays pickleball all the time. Again, how is pickleball not on there? That I guess that sport's just percolated up new enough or popular enough that now you guys recognize it. Skeezy, adjective, slang, morally or physically disgusting or repulsive. So skeezy is, this is here again. So to me, if I was writing my term paper at Manuka High School and I described something as skeezy, I think Miss Lynch or Mrs. Flatness would have circled it and said, that's not an appropriate word. You need to find better language. Now I have license to use skeezy. Is that right, Emily?
Well, it's important to note that it is labeled as slang in the dictionary, which means that it is still inappropriate for some kinds of, for some contexts, and certainly for formal, any kind of formal writing, right? We don't use slang words in our formal writing.
Well, that's
but
true.
A dictionary's job is to report the words of the language as they exist and also to offer this kind of guidance that tells somebody that skeezy is a word, this is what it means, but it's a slang word, or that the word sesh, meaning session, is informal, meaning these are not words that you want to pull out at most job interviews,
right?
But they are established words in the language.
Tall boy is the tall cylindrical can. It's a 16-ounce beer. We all know that in Chicago. We are familiar with tall boys, and you now have that as a as one word, T-A-L-L-B-O-Y or T-A-L-L space B-O-Y. But the one
that's right.
Getting attention, I think, too, with this latest inclusion of new words and definitions in the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, senior editor Emily Brewster's on a phone line, is one word in particular. And some people are rolling their eyes at the complication this word creates. What's that word? In a minute. Merriam-Webster's dictionary has over 500 new words or definitions of ones that you've heard before. And we're visiting with the senior editor about that, Emily Brewster. The word that we sort of teased there, Emily, is the word they. What did you guys do to the definition of the word they?
We added a meaning of the word they, used to refer to a single person whose gender identity is non-binary. So this would be the use that is in a sentence like, here is my friend Jay, they are joining us for dinner tonight.
How confusing is that?
It confuses some people, for sure. We are not used to the word they being used so explicitly with a plural verb, they are, and referring to one person. But the word they has been referring to a single person since the days of Chaucer, actually before the advent of modern English, but in sentences like, no one has to use it if they don't want to, for example. In that case, they refers back to no one, that's one person. And so we're all used to that particular use, but this is a newly established use. It's a use that dates most likely to this century.
What's the reaction been to the definition of they as a single person whose gender identity is non-binary? What are people saying about that?
Well, the people who use that as their personal pronoun are pretty excited about it. People who do not use it and don't know anybody who uses it tend to feel like it's very strange, and that it is that it's not actually grammatical. And so that is a concern that we are hearing.
I guess the learning curve for all of us is that while that word should suffice, if I said he or she, you'd know what I was talking about. If I say they, you're going to get about 8 more sentences between you and me as to what I mean and who we're talking about. You know what I mean?
Sure, especially in a first encounter with it.
So I'll say, this is so awkward, right? So here's my friend Joe. They are going to join us for dinner. And then my mother would say, well, who's Joe bringing? And I would say, no, it's just Joe. And then she would say, but you just said they. And then I'll go, yeah, we have to talk. That's That's where the use of they goes. Maybe if the pronoun to describe people whose identity is fluid, if the pronoun did not already mean something that was, in fact, in conflict with the previous definition, right? Because they means more than one. That's the definition of they. It would be more than one person. So maybe
that's
we need a new word. I mean, it wasn't your decision. This is the way the language evolved. But they is inherently confusing when you're describing a person whose gender is non-binary.
That's true. It is confusing at first, and there are other pronouns that have been proposed, like Z, as in the letter Z-E. Right. But none of those are appearing in published edited text the way we need them to do for us to recognize them as established members of the language. But in talking about this issue, it can be really helpful to learn that the word you used to be exclusively plural. And in the 14th century, ye and you began to be used for only one person. And then centuries later, by the 17th century, thou and thee had completely fallen out of the language except for in the most intimate kind of relationships. And you was being used for everybody. And this is why, even when I am speaking to you, one person, I use a plural verb. I don't say you is, I say you are. So we already, in our running speech, every native English speaker uses a plural verb with a singular pronoun every day.
Right, but that's referring to the number of people, not the identity of the person, not the perceived gender of the person, and that's also part of the complication.
Sure, yes, yes. But as far as the actual grammar construction goes.
Yeah, I get your point. John, on they issue, please put me in the eye-rolling camp, says 630. But it's a big bus. I've got room for everybody. I'm just saying that the rollout of a new word or definition is going to be clunky sometimes. 309 says this: I have to ask if they added the word bigly for our illustrious president. That's interesting. Donald Trump would probably introduce some new phrases or language ideas. Is bigly going to be in the dictionary anytime soon?
Well, in order for a word like bigly to get into our dictionary, it would need to be used by many people and over a longer period of time. And then we would consider it for entry. But right now, it's more a word that is talked about than it is used widely.
But an interesting distinction. That's why Emily Brewster is a senior editor at Merriam-Webster. New words in the new dictionary, definitions of old ones. Emily, thanks for your time. Keep doing what you do over there. I appreciate your time this afternoon.
Oh, thank you so much.